Okay, welcome everybody. It's the last of this series. We look forward. Shuli, we work her hard, but please God, we'll give her a few weeks off till she comes up with another idea for a new series. But really, always a pleasure to learn with her. And her popularity is, you know, as you see, is very much, and her teaching is wonderful. And we're so pleased that she has given so many classes over the years, past 4 years, I guess, at Torah Motion. I want to thank the sponsor of today's class, Naomi and Mark Chernin, who are dedicating the class for the end of saying Kaddish for Mark's mother, Gita Chernin. I think should have many happy occasions. Kaddish is very powerful and the more practical way, the obvious way, public way, we memorialize somebody. So we should have occasions for many happy occasions for the future. Also want to thank Oreret Marty and Sharon Goldberg, who've been sponsoring the whole series in memory of Sharon's father, Yecheska ben Yerachmiel, whatever. It's on the honor of his 15th yahrzeit. And again, we should have many happy occasions to come together to learn Torah. Torah is always the bridge between life and death. Torah is Torah Chaim. That's why we learn Torah in memory of people. It's sort of, as the Gemara says, the lips of the person in the grave moves when we study Torah. Very powerful, beautiful image that we'll leave for another time. And with that, Shuli, Vavakasha, it's all yours.
Thank you. Okay. So I'll explain why we're doing this class, which in some ways doesn't really fit with the rest of the series. First of all, as always, our class is for the refuah shlema of all of the wounded, for the return, the immediate return of all of the hostages, and for our success in this terrible war. Just coming from a shiva of a soldier, it's never ending, this whole story. So what's the idea behind doing this class? So we've gone through the history of the area of Gaza, of the area of the Otef. We went last time all the way up to the time period of the disengagement from Gush Katif and talking about the new communities that were developed after we left Yamit and Gush Katif. And really the most natural thing now would be to do a class on the war 2014, and then of course on October 7th, but I really didn't want to do that. And there's plenty of other places where you can get that information. And I guess what I was thinking about was memorializing, remembering, because now we're still in the midst of everything that's going on. We're in the thick of everything that's going on. But soon, I hope sooner rather than later, this is going to be over. And we're going to start thinking about how do we remember and how do we commemorate? People are already talking about this. Is Simchas Torah's definition going to change? Because, you know, how can we ever have Simchas Torah again? What kind of memorials are we going to create to the victims? How are we going to incorporate this into our calendar? So that was one thing that I was thinking about. And also, so much of what has happened since October 7th, for people who know a little bit of Israel's history, it definitely reminds us of the Yom Kippur War in the sense of our being unprepared and kind of stuck in what we call in Hebrew a conceptia, right? The conception of what was supposed to happen, which didn't happen, and also the Yom Kippur War in the sense that while the generals were not so successful, the people were incredibly successful and brave. But we also are going back in many ways to another war of independence. We're going back to 1948. This is the war that is about our survival, just like that 1948 war was. And just as that one, when it was over, led to many questions about our identity and how do we act as Jews and as Israelis, I think this war is going to lead back to that too. And we're hearing so often about soldiers who are turning to Judaism. You know, they want tzitzit, they want tefillin, they're bringing out a safer Torah to the battlefield. And in a way, it's almost a redefinition of how we serve Hashem. It's not going back to Judaism of the exile, but it's also not going back to Zionism that is empty of Judaism. So all of those reasons together kind of led me back to this class, which was created not for this occasion, but I think still has a lot of relevance. Okay, so with that very, very long introduction, Judaism has always adapted to wherever they are, right? We take the outside vessel of the language, of the clothing, of the food, of wherever we are, and we pour in our content. But today, we've come back to our ancient land, right? We've lost the traditions of the land. We have to create new ones. We also have this kibbutz galuyot. Each group of us is coming from different places. How do we bring those things together? Do we return to the way things were? Do we, when we were here originally, do we go back to our exile Judaism, or do we try to create some kind of a new hybrid? And the picture that you have here is an interesting picture because it's a soldier on Mount Herzl, and Mount Herzl itself is very much a hybrid. And here we have a chayelet, right? A female soldier, something that we definitely did not have in the past or did not have very often, okay? With an Israeli flag with black ribbons, right? Not particularly a Jewish idea. But of course, the idea of honoring the dead and the flag that looks like a tallit, a lot of mixed metaphors that are going on. Okay. As we get started, just realize there are sources. I posted them in the chat. You'll see them also as we go, but just you can have them in the chat as well. Okay, moving along. So the original impetus for the idea for this class was, I mean, there's been so many things since then, but we remember almost 3 years ago now, we had the terrible, terrible tragedy in Meron, right, on Lag BaOmer, where you had all the victims, this terrible stampede, 45 people who were killed. All the victims were ultra-Orthodox, were Haredim, because that's most of the people who go to Meron on Lag BaOmer. And one of the things that was fascinating was that on the one hand, everybody was Haredi, right? And their way of looking at the state is definitely not the way that secular people look at the state. On the other hand, Israel, all of Israel was in mourning, and the government declared a national day of mourning, which included flags flying at half mast, which included sad songs on the radio, right? All an official national day of mourning, which we don't have very often, by the way, besides the regular ones. So on the one hand, it was a beautiful response to this terrible tragedy that affected really only one community. On the other hand, how much did that community appreciate this response? It's not a traditional way of mourning, right? Now, on the other side, you could see the then president of Israel, Ruvi Rivlin, doing a much more traditional idea of lighting Yahrzeit candles. People went Shiva visits, right? Today, in the wake of 5 months of the war already, we are seeing, that everybody's going to Shivas, ultra-Orthodox to ultra-secular, everybody's going to soldier Shivas. But here you had this really unusual circumstance where you had a lot of secular people going to these very, very ultra-Orthodox Shivas. So you had both. You had this kind of a national, governmental, secular commemoration. On the other hand, you had all of the traditional Jewish things that we do when someone dies, right? So this sort of brought this question to the fore, in I thought a very interesting way. So this brings us back to questions about what is our idea of the state from the beginning. Okay, so when we think about Theodor Herzl, right, and his vision of political Zionism, the idea was to create a solution to what was called then the Jewish problem, right? We need to bring Jews to create their state so they can be safe, and then they can be just like everybody else, right? So look at the source here. The Jews who wish for a state shall have it. We shall live at last as a free people on our soil and die peacefully in our homes. The world will be liberated by our freedom, enriched by our wealth, magnified by our greatness, and whatever we attempt there to accomplish for our own welfare will react powerfully and beneficially for the good of humanity. We'll leave aside for a moment that unfortunately Herzl's vision that once we leave Europe, everybody will love us didn't quite come true. But what I think is fascinating here is that we're going to live at last as a free people on our own soil. We're going to be like everybody else. We're not going to be different anymore. And at a certain point in Herzl's journey, when he was very depressed and things were not working out, he wrote a novel called Alt Neuland. A lot of people have heard of it, I'm sure. Old New Land, right? And it's a utopian vision of this land, right? Somebody's going to come from the future, in the future, and see what the land looks like. And yes, there's going to be a little Judaism. They'll go to the Western Wall, but mostly it's this place that is full of amazing technology, European culture, whatever language is practical. There's no idea of returning to our Jewish roots, and certainly no idea of revitalizing our Judaism. Right? Now, contrasted to that is this gentleman, right, whose name is Asher Zvi Ginzburg, but known much better by his pen name, Echad Ha'am, right? And he did not see the land of Israel and a Jewish state as a problem to solve the Jewish problem. It's not going to be a home for all Jews. Rather, right, he created something that we call cultural Zionism. It will change Judaism, right? He says we have to revitalize the Jewish soul and not just save Jewish bodies. And that's a very different idea. It's not looking as Israel as just a refuge. It's looking at it as a place to really change Judaism. Right, and what does he say? And he wrote it an awful lot. I just brought you one from one article, The Jewish State and the Jewish Problem. It is not only the Jews who have come out of the ghetto. Judaism has come out too. Judaism has come out, or is coming out of its own accord whenever it has come into, wherever it has come into contact with modern culture. The spirit of our people desires further development. It wants to absorb the basic elements of general culture, which are reaching it from the outside world, to digest them and make them a part of itself, as it has done before at various periods of its history, right? Judaism is opening up to the outside world. Remember, Echad Ha'am, living during the time period post-Enlightenment, Jews are moving out of the ghetto, they're assimilating, they're aware of the outside world. He says we should take those elements of general culture and make them our own, right? Which we've seen throughout Jewish history. Then from this center, the spirit of Judaism will radiate to the great circumference, to all the communities of the diaspora, to inspire them with new life. Echad Ha'am doesn't believe that everybody should move to Israel, okay? Or that everybody needs to move to Israel. Rather, he sees Israel as the center that is going to change Judaism. And until today, we're having this debate, right? We talk about should everybody be making aliyah, or should there be vibrant communities in other places? And Israel will be the focus of this new idea. So Echad Ha'am, not looking to make us like everybody else, right? Very different from Herzl. And yet another approach is, of course, the Rav Kook, right? Rav Kook was admiring not only of all the secular pioneers, right? He came to Israel and, you know, he obviously, take a look at him, was living a completely orthodox lifestyle. He was a huge Talmid Chacham. He was respected by all parts of the spectrum, but he had great respect for the pioneers, right? For these very secular pioneers. But not only that, he is very jealous of their revolutionary spirit, because he also agrees with Echad Ha'am that Judaism needs to be reinvented. It needs to be revitalized. Rabbi Ari Schwat, who wrote a lot about Rav Kook, says Rav Kook believed that the reason that the Jews of his generation, the young Jews, were rebelling against religion, right? They grew up in religious homes, but they left it behind. He says they were rebelling against the religion of the exile. If we return to the original religion of Eretz Yisrael, right, working the land, social justice, self-defense, Hebrew, then they'll all return, which is a fascinating possibility, which I think we're seeing a little bit of now, right? But look at what he writes. He wants to have this spiritual revolution. I walk around with an overwhelming jealousy of the secular world. It is a jealousy that consumes me. For is it really possible that the power of creativity has ceased within the religious world? There is no one who is willing to explain, expand, and help the world appreciate these holy ideas, nor is there anyone who is striving to help actualize them into practical deeds. And thus, concerning all this, I become sick and suffer great pains of the soul. These are my sufferings of love that cause me to call out in a great voice to proclaim a spiritual revolution. He sees all these young revolutionaries. He says, don't leave your revolution behind. Bring it to Judaism, right? Bring it to Judaism and revitalize it. And the more famous piece here is the second one from an article called Hador, right? The Generation. And he wrote it in 1906. He had already come to Israel. He sees these pioneers who he admires so much, but he wants them to return to Judaism. And this is what he says: "Our generation is a magnificent generation, a generation that is full of wonder. It is hard to find its like in our history. It is made up of opposites. Light and dark are mixed together. It is low and downtrodden, high and lifted up, wholly guilty, also wholly innocent. The hearts of the fathers will begin to see the treasures of good and the hidden specialness in the sons. In the depths of their living and awoken souls, the sons will see the holiness and purity, the glory and grandeur that fill the hearts of the fathers who have kept them as an inheritance for generations. It is only through the spiritual uniting of young Israel with old Israel that the redemption will come." Okay, so unlike Herzl, we shouldn't be like all the nations. Unlike Ahad Ha'am, who wants to revitalize Judaism but wants to throw out a lot, Rav Kook really wants to take the old and the new and to mix it together. And of course, we have his famous quote here, right? Hayashan yitchadesh v'hachadash yitkadesh. It sounds much better in Hebrew. The old shall be made new, and the new shall be made sanctified. Right? And Rav Kook, and I think so much of what he wrote in 1906 is applicable in 2024, and it's really actually astounding to see. One more kind of introductory thing, and then we'll dive into some specifics. The first time that the new pioneers of the first Aliyah have to deal with Shemitah, right? That's when this brings this concept to a fore. Do we keep the halacha, right? The old halacha, which is of course tied to the land, but which hadn't been kept for centuries upon centuries because no one was living in the land? Or do we say this halacha can't apply to us anymore because we have to make a living, we have to survive here, right? And ultimately, what grows out of this is the heter mechira, right? This temporary permission to sell the land so that we can work it. That's a whole other class. But we have these great quotes from the Netziv, from Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who originally was a proponent of this heter mechira, but then he turned against it because he sees that it will take away from the holiness of the land of Israel. And he says, "The land of Israel is still holy today. The spirit of the Torah is why it survives. Like the existence of Israel among the nations is because of keeping the Torah. A piece of land is not the reason for our survival. Judaism is our land and our existence. And we must understand that we are not here to settle the land of the Philistines, but to settle souls in a land holy to God and to Israel, his people." Meaning, if we become like everybody else, then why have we come to Israel, right? What's the point? Is it all about just saving us physically? No, we also have to save ourselves as a people. We have to save our souls. We have to live here with Torah. So this is very nice to say. It's not very easy to do, certainly when we come to practical things. And again, we could talk about this so much with Shemitah, with how hospitals run in Israel. Anybody who's ever visited Machon Somet and knows how they work with the army and the hospitals. It's not easy to have a Jewish state after 2,000 years, but these are the questions that we're dealing with. And Martin Buber in 1942 will just, finish this introduction with his quote, because it's a great quote. "If we want to be nothing but normal, we shall soon cease to be at all." We cannot be a nation like all the other nations, whether or not we want to, right? And again, October 7th kind of slapped us in the face with that. We want to be high tech. We want to have peace with the Emirates. We want to be, no, we're not like everybody else, and we'll never be like everybody else, both because the outside world won't let us and because we're different in a good way, in a beautiful way. One of the ways that comes to the fore, of course, in Israel is this idea of being a light unto the nation. So again, I should probably replace this with a newer picture, but I still think it's a great picture. If you remember, 2.5 years ago, 2021, July 2021, when the building collapsed in Surfside, Florida, right? And we have so many examples of this. Who are the first people on the ground? Both because we have so much experience, but also because we want to be the ones who are going to save people, right? It's the Israeli teams. The Israeli teams are there, are helping, whether it's here, it's earthquakes in Turkey, it's tsunamis in Japan, it's everywhere, right? Wherever countries will let us in, we are sending our rescue teams to be there first. We feel this responsibility. We feel that we can't just say, oh, it's not happening in our country, all is good, we're gonna close our doors and just be fine, right? We don't feel like that ever. So let's go into a few examples. When we have the beginnings of Jewish self-defense, right? Jews start coming back to the land, and they start to realize that they cannot rely on the Arabs for defense, and they start to create Jewish self-defense organizations. The Gidonim, Hashomer, ultimately becomes the Haganah, right? What are our models? Okay, we don't have Jewish self-defense really after Bar Kokhba. We have a few examples: Crusaders, Jews against the Crusaders. Jerusalem, Jews in medieval Spain, like Shmuel HaNagid, but mostly Jews did not engage in fighting in the diaspora. And in 1909, you have the founding of Hashomer. Their motto really goes back to Jewish history. It says, "Bidam va'esh Yuda nafla, bidam va'esh Yuda takum." Right? Judea fell with blood and fire. Judea will rise again with blood and fire. Right? But their immediate models, right? That might be their deep past models, but their immediate models, take a look. Who are they dressing like, right? They're dressing like the local Arabs. Sometimes they're even dressing like Cossacks. They're learning Arabic. They're riding horseback. They're trying to be like the local Arabs, who that's their model, right? We see them as successful models to follow and maybe to usurp, but there's also a model of going back to our distant past, right? Back to the heroes of the Maccabees, Bar Kokhba, Masada, right? And so you have all these examples, right? I love this one. I've used this in a Hanukkah class many times, right? This one here on the left. Give your Dmei Hanukkah, give your Hanukkah gelt to the JNF, because here's the pioneer, and who's standing behind him? The Maccabee, right? We're really the same. Bayamim ahem, Bazman hazeh. It's the same. They are the fighters then, we are the fighters now. And of course, we have the Maccabi, Merot HaLapid, we have the Maccabiah, right? Maccabi is so important. Bar Kokhba on the Knesset menorah, that's the picture here on the right. The anthem, Jabotinsky's anthem for Beitar, talks about Beitar, Masada, and Yodfat, right? We are harking back to our fighters of old. So again, we have those two different influences, local influence, completely not Jewish, but we also have our Jewish influences. What about our language, right? What should our national language be? Today you ask this question and people are like, of course it should be Hebrew, right? Hebrew. We all know it was not so easy to have Hebrew. In the beginning, in the very first institution of higher learning in the modern land of Israel, which was not Hebrew University, but the Technion in Haifa. And that's the picture of this in the middle here. It was originally called the Technikum. And the language of instruction was meant to be the language of the early 1900s, the scientific language, which of course was German. Right? They were going to teach in, because German was the scientific language. And that made so much sense, because then you could read all of the journals and you could converse with your colleagues. And of course we should speak in German, but there was an uproar. There was a battle. This was called the Language Wars, 1913, right? Jews are always finding things to fight about. Already, Eliezer Ben Yehuda had been working on recreating the Hebrew language for more than 30 years by that point in 1913. And Hebrew was definitely a viable language, and people went out into the streets protesting that we have to have Hebrew and not German. Hey, there's already a whole culture of Hebrew. There are kindergartens in Hebrew and teacher seminaries and newspapers. And it's, again, we say, oh, is it going back to the old? Not really, right? Because Eliezer Ben Yehuda created words for the train and electricity and tomato and all these things that they didn't have in the time of Tanakh. So it's an amalgam of old and new. Obviously, Hebrew won the battle, even though English is now winning the battle in some institutions of higher learning. But this was also one of these battlegrounds of who are we going to be? Are we going to be like everybody else? Are we going to be different? So if you look at there's the Technion in the middle, on the left here, You have a sign about a general meeting, asefa pumbit gdola, a big public meeting, the nose, the theme, hasafa ha'ivrit, sfat halimud bebate sefer ha'ivriim be'eretz Yisrael. Right? The theme is the point of the meeting is the Hebrew language. Should it be the language of instruction in schools, in the Hebrew schools in the land of Israel? And on the right here, you have in the newspaper, it's a shir ha-nitzachon. It's a victory song when Hebrew actually won the war. Hey, hey, dad, hey, dad, ha-giborim, ha-talmidim, ba-hamorim, nitzcha sifspatenu. Our language has prevailed. Hala, hala, komin satanim, hu kohenim, hu natan, miderech tchiyatenu, right? It's gonna all be, to keep us, to, try not to keep us from our revival. And it's gonna talk about the Technion, and we won't read the whole thing, but it definitely was not a given that Hebrew would become the main language. Okay, another interesting idea. What's our flag going to be? Okay, every nation needs a flag. We're going to look at sources about that in a minute. But a lot of people know that the inspiration for our flag is the Talit, right? And this is David Wolfson, 1897. David Wolfson, one of the great early Zionists, and philanthropist. Suddenly I had an inspiration. We already had a flag, the blue and the white of the Talit. And the first flag, right, the Betsy Ross of, sorry, Canadians, but for Americans, the Betsy Ross of the Israeli flag, is in Rishon LeZion in 1885. It was already used in the Zionist Congress in 1897. Okay. And this became our flag, but it was not the only suggestion. There were other suggestions. My favorite one, Theodor Herzl's suggestion for a flag was that it should have seven stars to symbolize the 7-hour work day, which anybody who knows anything about early Israel before, the 2000s, 7-hour work day, kind of not really a reality. Okay. But that was one of the ideas. Another idea was a lion. There were all sorts of suggestions. The blue and white of the Talit won out. But let's think about a flag itself. Is a flag a Jewish idea? So before we read the Hebrew source here, take a look at the English source on the left of Moshe Feinstein, right? A question that he was asked in 1957, should synagogues put up American and Israeli flags? Is that allowed, right? Many of us grew up in synagogues that had American and Israeli flags, certainly in synagogues in Israel, unless you're in the Haredi communities, there are Israeli flags. Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked this question, and he said, even though it is not appropriate to have a flag in the synagogue and certainly not by the Holy Ark, it is not a prohibition, but rather something that is emptiness and foolishness. So Rav Moshe Feinstein was not a big fan of the flag. But if you look back at our sources, flags could be argued actually come from Judaism, which is a fascinating idea, right? Look at the source up here from Bamidbar Rabbah, talking about the camp in the desert, right? We know in the desert, the tribes camped in a specific way, right, around the Mishkan, around the tabernacle, and they each had symbols. Simanim hayu lechol nasi v'nasi, mapa v'tseva al kol mapa. Okay? Every prince of the tribes had a symbol. Okay, it was a mapa, a piece of cloth, right? What we would call a flag. Mitzeva kol mapa. Each one had a different color. Seva kol mapa mapa. Kitzeva shel avanim tovot shehayu al libo shel Aaron. The flags matched the colors of the stones on the choshen, right? We know each tribe had his own stone, right? Reuven was red. Everyone had a different color. The flag was that same color. Mehem lamda hamalchut, right? The Bamidbar Rabbah goes on. Lamda hamalchut liyot osin. The nations of the world learned from us to create flags with colors. Kol shevet v'shevet nasi shelo tseva mapa shelo domel tseva shelavno. Right? Fascinating. The Bar Midbar Rabba sees, understood that there are flags in the world. Those flags actually come from Judaism. So I'm sure Rav Moshe Feinstein knew this source, but I guess he didn't think that it applied to our flags today. But perhaps a more appropriate source is the Rav, Right, the Rev in 1983 wrote an article about the flag, and he sees in it a symbol of Jewish survival and Kiddush Hashem. Right. Nonetheless, we must not lose sight of a law in the Shulchan Aruch to the effect that one who has been killed by non-Jews is buried in his clothes. I just heard about this again last week. Today, all of the soldiers who are killed and everyone from October 7th, they do not do taharas on them. They bury them in their clothes, exactly because of this reason, so that the blood may be seen and avenged. As it is written, I will hold the heathen innocent, but not in regard to the blood which they have shed. In other words, the clothes of the Jew acquires a certain sanctity when spattered with the blood of a martyr. How much more is this so of the blue and white flag, which has been immersed in the blood of thousands of young Jews who fell in the War of Independence defending the country and the population. It has a spark of sanctity that flows from devotion and self-sacrifice. We are enjoined to honor the flag and treat it with respect. Right? So the Rav, on the one hand, understands that a flag really is a nationalist idea, that is not necessarily a Jewish idea, but the Kiddush Hashem involved with the flag is what creates something Jewish about it, and that makes it holy. Just one last, cute thing about the flag. How Jewish is our flag? So we saw that it comes from the Talit. The colors, the blue and white, are from the Tehillet, right? The Magen David, of course, is a Jewish symbol, but it's a very late Jewish symbol. Really, a more appropriate Jewish symbol would be the menorah. What about the stripes, right? We say, the stripes on the tallit, the stripes on the flag, right? It matches so nicely. Not really. Those stripes are actually not a Jewish idea. They come from a Roman idea. Important Romans would wear cloaks that had stripes on them. It was called a latus clavus. That's what you see in this picture from Dura Europus, the synagogue from Syria. Anybody who's important has stripes on his clothes. So when the Chachamim would wear cloaks, would wrap themselves in cloaks, which they, of course, would put tzitzit on, that was their tallit, their cloaks had the stripes on them to show that they were important people. The stripes are not part of the halacha. The Sfardim have white on white. They don't have blue and white. So, even when we go back to our roots of the tallit, we're still influenced by outside cultures. So nothing is completely pure. When we get to the question of the War of Independence being over, okay, so now we've come to a new stage in our statehood. Okay, first we had battles for independence, we had the defense, we had the flag. Now we have created our state. How do we commemorate our independence? So already in 1949, 2 months after the war was over, the question was placed to the chief rabbis and in general in the religious establishment, can we make a new holiday to celebrate our independence? The two chief rabbis, right, Rav Meir Uziel, the Sephardi chief rabbi, Yitzchak Herzog, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi, the ones who are portrayed here, they say this is a day of prayer. And they create, along with Shai Agnon, this beautiful prayer of Avinu Shebashamayim that many of us are familiar with, that we say in our Bate Knesset. It's drawing from traditional sources, but it's saying Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. This is the beginning of the time of our redemption. Okay? It was also published in the newspaper for the first time. So again, something very, very modern. So here we are. We want to take this traditional model of tefillah. We want to take a traditional model of saying Hallel. On the other hand, we're creating something new. We're creating a holiday out of nothing, right? We're not attaching it to a holiday that we had already. We are creating a tefillah that is completely new, drawing from ancient sources, right? Avinu Shebashamayim, Tzvi Yisrael, Goalo, but coming up with new ideas. Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. This is the beginning of our Geula. Not everybody agrees with that, right? But we're going to do that. So that's the beginning. And the day, Independence Day in general, Yom HaTzmaut is a hybrid day. Okay? It's a strange day. On the one hand, it's a day where we celebrate military might, right? What we call Kochi Va'Otzem Yadi. Used to be military parades in the streets that stopped a while back. There was a question of bringing it back. But even today, when we don't have military parades, People go out to watch the flyovers, okay? People go to army bases to see all the technology. There's a lot of talk about our soldiers and bravery, and that's not very much a traditional idea. On the other hand, at least for religious Zionists, it's a day of prayer. It's a day of Hallel. It's a day of Tefillah. And you might think this is a bit of a stretch, but some people, anyone who's been in Israel on Yom HaTzmaut knows that. What do we do on Yom HaTzmaut? What is the one overriding custom that everybody does? You make a barbecue. If you didn't make a
Barbecue.
barbecue, you are not Yotzei Mitzvat Hayom. That is what everybody does. And there are those who suggest that this is harking back to the Beit HaMikdash and to sacrifices. And just like we had sacrifices on every holiday, we're going to have sacrifices again when the Beit HaMikdash is rebuilt. Meanwhile, we have a barbecue on Yom HaTzmaut. You could think it's a little far-fetched, but I think it's an interesting idea. So we are looking at Yom HaTzmaut. Here's this new challenge, this new day that we've never had such a thing in our history. How do we commemorate it? Even more complicated than that is how do we remember? How do we commemorate? And that's really what I started with. Okay? How do we commemorate the fallen? Because again, we have unfortunately many events in our history where people have died. We've had pogroms, we've had attacks, we've had times where we've been saved. We have keynote, we have all of those things, but we don't really have a situation where we remember fallen soldiers. How do we do that? First of all, what day do we choose? Okay. The choice is made to make the 4th of Iyar, the day before Yom HaAtzmaut, both as a connection between the sacrifices that were made to give us the state, right? So connection between Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut, as well as the fact that Gush Etzion fell on that day, on the 4th of Iyar. So that has a lot of resonance to it. In the beginning, this was really only a 12-hour day. It was only during the daytime and not at night. Then it was expanded. How do we commemorate it? What do we do? So we have new rituals alongside old, right? We have Kamalei Rachamim, we have Kaddish, we go to the graves, but we also our graves don't look exactly like the ancient graves did. Our military graves are a combination of Jewish ideas and Zionist ideas. With the great Aliyah from Russia, that changes even more. Okay, this is the memorial for Jewish Russian soldiers that was put up in our Herzl. The graves, take a look at the graves for a minute, right? The grave of Rav Kook here is on the left. It's a traditional Jewish grave, which we've all seen many examples of, right? Po Nikbar, the name, okay, the name of the father, and then whatever choice you choose to put into the, to the writing here, but usually it has the date of birth and the date of death. Rav Kook's has different dates. Allah la Eretz HaKodesh, when did he come to Israel? Allah Yushalayma, when did he come to Jerusalem? Allah HaShamayma. But it's all Hebrew dates, and it's all about coming to Israel, as well as his death and his name. Okay? A military grave contains some of those elements, but it contains others that are very foreign to a traditional Jewish grave. Okay? On the one hand, we have the person's name and his last name. We have his parents' names. Okay? Eliyahu Cohen ben Sophia v'Shaul HaCohen. Okay? On the other hand, we have his nickname. Okay? Not something you often see on traditional graves. You have the insignia of the army. You have his rank and his serial number. Okay, and one of the most interesting Zionist ideas, okay, it doesn't say his birth date. It says his Aliyah date, similar to Rav Kook. Nolad b'Mitzrayim, he was born in Egypt. Allah Tafshin Yud Zayin, he made Aliyah in 1957. Okay, because in the Zionist idea, you are reborn when you come to the land of Israel. And it tells you when he fell and the circumstances and how old he was. And again, let's go back to something Jewish at the end. So it's a real mishmash of the two, and I think a fascinating way. The other very famous way that we commemorate Yom HaZikaron is not just going to the cemetery, but we have a siren and moment of silence. We have this on Yom HaZikaron, we have this on Yom HaShoah. Anybody who has been in Israel for these days and has been out in the world, right, out on the street, out on the highway, you can't miss it. People stop their cars, they stand, they get up, they stand on the highway, everything stops. Is this a Jewish idea? And there are those that will say, okay, this is a Jewish idea. This is Vayidom Aaron. We have to be silent when something terrible happens. But there are others who say, siren, really? That's a Jewish idea? That's not a Jewish idea. It's a very Goyish idea. Even the standing at attention is not a very Jewish idea. And there have been attempts by Haredim who want to respect, but who don't like this, what they see as a non-Jewish custom. So some people will stand, but they will say Tehillim while they're standing. Other people will make it a point not to be outside while this is happening. There was even a petition that was brought before the Supreme Court to not have the sirens in a public place. The judge, Tzvi Halbertal, said, no, no, no. The whole idea is this is a cry in public. We are crying out together. And it's this amalgam of something very Zionist, not particularly Jewish, but it has become very Jewish while in the land of Israel. The other really interesting attempt to remember is Yom HaShoah. Okay, Yom HaShoah, first of all, Israel in its early days had very complicated feelings about the survivors and about Yom HaShoah. If you've gone to Yad Vashem, you've probably seen, not so much anymore because today people go into the new museum and they don't walk here, but in the old museum, you could not avoid these two reliefs. One is a statue, one is a relief by the sculptor Nathan Rappaport. The one on the right, shows this very traditional Jews being led with the Torah downtrodden, sheeps like sheep to slaughter. And the other one, of course, is the heroes of the Warsaw Ghetto who all look like Greek gods. Israel had a very hard time with the idea of survivors. They didn't understand what the survivors had gone through. They couldn't understand the Nazi war machine, and they really only wanted to commemorate the partisans, the fighters, resistance. And it took a long time for Israel to deal with that and for Yad Vashem to be about that. One of the places where the memorial is very different than Yad Vashem is on Har Tzion, where you have something called Martef HaShoah, the Chamber of the Holocaust. And this is a much more traditional way of remembering it. Harks back much more to the way Jews always remembered their dead, where you had people who came from various communities, created memorial plaques, brought their whatever was left from their communities, and it was a way for survivors to have a memorial to talk about spiritual resistance. But the official Israeli memorial site of Yad Vashem took them a very long time to accept this idea of spiritual resistance, to accept this idea of a more traditional way of mourning. And of course, the biggest question was, should we create a new day, right? Should we create a new day, or should the Holocaust be remembered as part of Jewish history? Okay? And there were arguments on both sides. Okay, very early on, Chazon Ish, the Brisker Rav, Rav Velvel Salobrechik, came out against this idea of having a new day of mourning, right? Take a look at the source on the right here from the Chazon Ish, who went with a very conservative idea. Matters of halacha are decided in accordance with the Torah, whose principles are set down in writing and whose interpretation is in the oral law. No prophet is entitled to introduce anything unless it has textual support in the Torah. Just as the diminishing of anything is a deviation from the Torah, likewise, adding to the commandments of the Torah is a deviation, right? There's no lo tosifu velo tigrao. Don't add and don't take away. Thus, the establishment of a fast for all future generations is a rabbinically ordained commandment. And that which we have today goes back to the time when there was still prophecy, right? Anything that was added in the time of the prophets. How can we presume as a generation that is better off remaining silent to even think of establishing matters for future generations? The very suggestion testifies to our denial of all our sins and our shortcomings. So long as we are soiled with transgressions and iniquities, destitute and empty of Torah, bare of commandments, let us not approach things too great for us. Let us search our ways and repent. This is our obligation. And he can't imagine that we are worthy of creating a new day, right? We have to have continuity. Holocaust is part of the continuity of Jewish history. We'll mourn as we always have mourned on Tisha B'Av. Others, most famously, the Netivot Shalom, the Slonim Rebbe, said, how can we not have a day? The Holocaust is unlike anything. Yes, it fits into the pattern of Jewish history, but it shatters it. And how can we not respect those who died, those who were murdered, with a day of their own? All right, so take a look at what he says, that we were unable to do anything to stop the way they were annihilated. Our hearts are pained that even after the great cataclysm, no commemoration for them has been established for the future. Some form of eulogy and mourning in the manner established by the sages of Jewry after the pogroms of 1548 and 9, when they ordained the 20th of Sivan for fasting and reciting Slichot. Despite the relatively small dimension of that series of tragedies, why should the tragedy of the Holocaust be different from all those tragedies? They certainly deserve a fast day and keynote of their own. So you have these two approaches, both of them from the Orthodox world, right? One saying, we're not worthy of creating a new day, and the other saying, we're not worthy of not creating a new day. And ultimately, what happened, right? What happened is really a tragedy, because different communities commemorated different things. Right? The secular world said, okay, we're going to create the 27th of Nisan, Yom HaZikaron LaShoah V'Gagvura. Why? Why the 27th of Nisan? It's a strange date. Because the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising began on Erev Pesach. Obviously, we cannot have Yom HaShoah on Erev Pesach, so let's push it till the week after Pesach. It'll identify us with the partisans, with courage, with all of those themes that we have in Yad Vashem, 27th of Nisan. The Orthodox said, what are you talking about? Nisan is not a mourning. We can't mourn Nisan. And in any case, no new days. So we're going to remember Yom HaShoah on the ninth day of Av, like we remember everything else. Okay? Some people from the national religious world said, well, let's have a compromise. Let's make it the 10th of Tevet, right? Asara B'Tevet, Yom HaKadisha Klali. It's the day that we mourn all those people whose dates of death we don't know. Okay? And we ended up having, right, Rabbi J.J. Schachter, who wrote an article about this, basically says we lost everything because we don't have any ritual on the 27th of Nisan. And a day without ritual is not a compelling day. But the 9th of Av is so full of other Jewish tragedies that the Holocaust gets swallowed up by it. And the 10th of Tevet, essentially nobody connects to the Holocaust, or very few people. So all of these attempts to make everybody happy ended up that we do not have a good compromise and a good solution to how we commemorate the Holocaust. Okay, before we get to the end, and I realize we have many, many different ideas, some of them competing here, a lot of different questions. One of them, of course, is something that was talked about a lot in the last year. Are we a Jewish state? Are we a democratic state? Can we be both? Okay. And that is definitely one of the issues and one of the questions that we think about. But I wanted to end here with music, because I think music is a great example of how cultures come through in a lot of different ways. So one of the greatest of our poets and our composers was Naomi Shemer. And Naomi Shemer, while she wasn't a religious person, was steeped in the sources. She knew the sources backwards and forwards. And her most famous song, which of course is Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, I'm not going to play it for you, but you all know it, is full of references to Tanakh, to Mishnah, to medieval poetry, right? Just go to the most famous part, right? To the refrain. Halo l'chol shirayich ani kinor, right? That's coming from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. She's going back to the Barot HaMayim. She's going back to look at the last paragraph here, Likshor Ketarim, right? Going back to the Midrash about Moshe going up to the heavens and seeing God tying crowns on the letters. Okay? Even Ha'ir Asher Badad Yoshevet, the city that sits alone, is coming from Echa. So many different sources, and she's taking those ancient sources and really blending them into something very modern and very new. And finally, and we're going to try this. It didn't work last time. We're going to try to make it work this time. I'm going to play one song for you, but before we do that, something fascinating that's happening in the last few years. Hey, the first song I brought you here is actually an old song, but using Tanakh as an inspiration for new songs, right? And often new rock songs. So the example that I brought here is from the 70s, HaChalonot HaGvohim. It is called Yechezkel. And on the one hand, it's clearly by somebody who knows a little bit about Tanakh. He knows about Yechezkel, right? The prophet Ezekiel. But on the other hand, it's a completely disrespectful song. It's actually a rather funny song, but it's a very disrespectful song. So if you take a look at it, right, this is the one here on the left. I did not translate it, but we'll translate it as we go. Anu ba'ad ha'navi Yechezkel, nelech acharav im tarmil makel, el kol makom she'otanu yavi, ha'navi Yechezkel hu bomba shel navi. Okay, we are in favor of the prophet Ezekiel. We'll go after him with a knapsack and a walking stick. Any place he brings us, we'll go with him because he is a bomba shel navi. He's a superstar. He's the greatest of the Nevi'im. Ach, eze gever, ach, eze ish. What a guy he was, right? Shtei einayim ke'evin tarshish. He had two eyes that were like the stones of these precious stones. Im malachim hu achal v'shata. He ate and drank with the angels. Hu ve'elokim kmo ani v'ata. He and God, it's like me and you, right? That's how close they were, right? And he goes on and on about his dreams, and finally go to the bottom part. Laila echad kishe'enav atzumot ba'el. One night while his eyes were closed, he came to the valley full of dry bones. Etel em el etzem chiber v'asaf, bone after bone he put together. Elef chatichot az halchu acharav. Really not translatable. 1,000 pieces went after him, but chatichot, of course, is babes, right? Cute girls. So it's a very disrespectful song, but it's actually a rather funny song. But it presumes a level of knowledge of Tanakh. Is it something that Rav Kook would have welcomed? Oh my gosh, no. Is it something that Herzl would have welcomed? No, because he would have wanted European, classical music. But it's a very Israeli amalgam of the ancient and the modern. But one that I think is actually a lot nicer, and this is something that's happening a lot these days, is people not setting Tanakh text to music, although that's happening as well, but riffing off of, building off of Tanakh texts. And this is a songwriter who has become a huge hit, a huge superstar in Israel, despite the fact that he's a religious guy who has a bunch of kids. He wears a kippah, but he is a cross-cultural phenomenon, and that's Hanan Ben Ari. If you've never heard of Hanan Ben Ari, go listen to some of his songs. We'll read through the words, and like I said, we'll try and play the song because it's a great song. And it's called Cholem Kmo Yosef. I'm dreaming like Yosef. This was a huge hit a couple of years ago. And he takes ideas from Tanakh and he applies them to himself, to everybody. Kol Adam Migorash Migan Eden. Every person was exiled from the Garden of Eden. Kol echad over mabul. Everybody has gone through the flood. Lechol echad yesh eze hevel shehu mekaneh bo ad mavet. Everybody has a hevel, right? Like Cain and Hevel, that he is jealous of him till death. Bechol echad migdal shel mered vibilbul. All of us have within us a tower of rebellion and confusion, right? Like the Tower of Babel. Kol adam holech lo mi beit abba. All of us leave our father's home. Kol echad kim'at okedet. No, all of us almost sacrifice our children, okay? Well, something that's very appropriate today in Israel. All of us have this little Sodom inside of us that we just want to erase. We have angels that will save us. And also I dream like Joseph. And even I was thrown into the pit. It's a wheel that turns around. It's disguised, but it's the same. And like King David, I make out of it a song. And then he goes to the women. All of us are queens like Esther. All of us are queens like Esther. We defeat like Dvorah any enemy that comes against us, any army. Like all of us, she also cries in secret. Like Rachel, like Moshe on Mount Nebo. And then he goes on the same refrain, and then he ends. Kol Adam Nivra B'Tselem. Everybody is created in the image of God. Gachal Bo'er Sodot Rimazim. A flaming ember full of secrets and hints. Kol Echad Hu Chomer Tov L'Seret. All of us are good material for a movie. Tavkid Chadash B'Toch Sipor Atik Yomin. A new role within a very ancient story. And that's really where we are. We're a new role within a very ancient story. And I'm going to try. You guys will tell me if you're hearing it. I don't know. Last time it didn't work. This time we're going to hope that it will work. Hold on. Not here. Just a second. Give me a thumbs up if you're hearing something. Not hearing? Why does this not work? I don't
No, but
understand. Okay, I don't understand why it doesn't
you
work.
have to share your audio.
I thought I did that. Let's try that again. All right, here we go. All right, one more time.
Yes.
צלם כחל בוער סודות ורמזים כל אחד הוא חומר טוב לסרט תפקיד חדש בתוך סיפור עתיק יומי
Okay, one of the things that is great about that, you might not have loved that video, but he's not sitting in Yudan Shomron. He's not in Ma'arat HaMachpelah. He's running through the streets of Tel Aviv. Okay, and that's part of the story here. Okay, let's take a look at questions that we have here. Oh my goodness. All right. Yeah, is wanting tzitzit superstition? That's an interesting question. I am not going to judge any of our soldiers. Rob Cook had a right to be jealous of the early Zionists. Secular founders were saying, yes, but that's not what he was jealous of that, but that's not what he meant here. He meant the creativity. Yodfat was a battle in the Great Revolt. Josephus was there and he basically surrendered, but it's a battle where the Jews fought the Romans to the death. Torah Ba'aretz Institute. Okay. I don't know what that is. Yiddish was a language, but not the only language. There were people coming from all over and, it was definitely, Yiddish was very frowned upon actually in the early days of the state. Rav Moshe was against flags in a shul. Okay, I hear that. The Magen David became a Jewish symbol 17th century or so. The Chagall windows, yes and no, meaning he sort of followed sources, but he sort of did his own thing. So I'm not sure they're all 100% the colors of the Choshen. Secrets of the Magen David, oh, sounds interesting. Exact birth date of... Who, Susanna? I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, there was that that gravestone that didn't have that only had how old?
No, none of them do. None of them have birth dates. They all say the date of Aliyah. They do not say a date of birth. I've seen many of them in Har Herzl. It's a thing. Now the more modern ones from the Russians who have come now, they do have it, but the traditional old ones in Har Herzl don't. Okay, Bikurim. Yeah, okay. I didn't. Varying stance of Israel regarding fully commemorating the Holocaust mourning. No, I'm saying in the past, right, in the 50s and the 60s, Israel had a lot of trouble dealing with survivors, dealing with the Holocaust. That's a whole other class in and of itself. But again, ultra-Orthodox have their own approach to it, so it's different. Okay, those who are opposed to sirens, flags, because they are not Jewish, would be happy to go back to slavery. I'm not getting this point so much, but okay. Chana Senesh and Embers and Secrets, nice. Yes, Hanan Ben Ari is amazing. You should follow Hanan Ben Ari. His songs are fabulous. All right. Thank you. The conflict of, what is this? Ne'ilah on the Tel Aviv. Oh, Ne'ilah. Yes. Okay. Yes. We have a lot of questions about how we deal with religion and maybe we'll have some new thoughts in the future. We can only hope. All right. Thank you, everybody. And thank you for indulging a kind of a strange class, but I hope that we liked it. And everyone should have a good rest of the week, and we should hear Bisorot Tovot.
Amen.
Thank you, Shuli. Thank you. Okay. I'd like to stay for the whole class today, but thank you very much. And thank you for the series, all your wonderful teaching. Just a couple of important announcements. Tonight, we'll send them an email, but Rabbi Helfgott here tonight is going to be starting at 9 as opposed to 8:30 as it has to be somewhere before. So the Malachim Beit Shir tonight will be at 9 o'clock. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern, Rav Tabori, Aviad Tabori, a neighbor of Shuli's, will continue his series on religious and halachic challenges in the state of Israel. Tomorrow he'll be discussing the reestablishment of a Sanhedrin, doing a case study from 1538. That's a fascinating case study. And, of course, the applications for our time today. So that's tomorrow, 1 p.m. Eastern. Tomorrow night, 8:30 p.m. Eastern, our parsha, we're going to have Rabbi Mark Glass of Kansas City, Rabbi in Kansas City. And then I'll have my share in the Siddur, 9:15 on Sunday morning, as we're going from Gula to Tula. We're going to move from the Shema sort of into the Shmon Esrei, and all our regular classes next week, Rabbi Liebtag beginning on Sunday morning, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, please invite a friend. And okay, next Wednesday at noon, you can, or 7 p.m., you can enjoy the free time you'll have as this series has come to an end. But thank you very much, everybody. Be well. Thank you. And we look forward to learning you. Many opportunities to learn. And like I say, our best advertising is word of mouth. So please do invite a friend to come join a class. And they'll like it. They'll come to more. They'll invite some more friends. Okay, have a wonderful day, everybody. Be well. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Shuli.